Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:25 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 17th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought we'd kick off with Gilead Sciences because it's looking increasingly likely that they have at least one treatment for the coronavirus. The share was up about 8 or 9% today, but it's broken up and out of the base formation it put in last year. And it continues to improve upon that performance. What we're also seeing is that Abbott Laboratories has brought forward the production of its rapid testing facility, and it's also a dividend aristocrat, and that's also helped to push it on to new high ground. They are producing 50,000 tests a day right now, but they expect to ramp that up over the course of the next month and have rapid testing, as in a result within 5 minutes, for the general population by June. Then when we look at antibody tests, it would be nice to know, do people actually have any form of immunity? Well, Regeneron is the primary company that is producing antibody tests, and they are also ramping up their production. The share also continues to rebound. And when then we think about the potential for a vaccine, well, the company that is furthest along in the clinical trials for that is Moderna, and that was up in excess of 10% in here today. They are moving now into phase two. They finished their phase one trial last month, and they were expected to get into phase two in the second quarter, but they just received additional funding from the US government to move into that phase two trial now. So that's the reason why it is popping on the upside. And I thought it was important to lead with these four shares in here today, because not only do they represent some relative strength in the market, but if we think about the next 3 months, they're probably the kinds of companies that are going to do well, irrespective of what else happens. But from a medium-term perspective, the success that they're having is also very much combined with where the recovery trajectory is likely to go. There are obviously going to be some countries that come out of the coronavirus scare in much better condition than they than others. And there are significant fears about a change to consumer behavior and what that's likely to mean. The reality is that if we look at the lockdowns, Sweden is in engaged in an experiment. So far, they have resisted any temptation to engage in the same kind of lockdown that their neighbors have, or the much of the rest of Europe or the world has. And they are going for straight out herd immunity. That's obviously at a significant human cost. Something that I have been referring to, or I referred to back in February, as euthanasia. And we have to pay attention to the fact that euthanasia was quite popular in the early 1900s in a number of the Nordic countries as well. So the reality is that they are engaging in this kind of experiment that they can get through the rise in deaths quicker, that because their assumption is to give up all hope that there is going to be any kind of solution. They may benefit from the fact that the rest of the world is engaging in attempting to find a solution. The only reason that a country would abandon a lockdown in advance of coming up with a solution is because they give up hope that there will be a solution. I think ultimately Sweden's experiment is going to prove fateful for the assumption that technology is incapable of delivering in a short time period. The reality is that one of the inhibiting factors in technological innovation is regulations. And if regulations are eased, then the speed with which solutions can be delivered accelerates at a really quite incredible pace. And that's exactly what we're seeing today with a number of these solution-oriented companies. Now, let's then take a big step back and think about what exactly is going on. Because the FANG sector has done especially well. And that is only 10 companies. It was in mildly negative territory in here today. But to go from 2,500 to 3,500 in the space of little more than 4 weeks is really quite an incredible performance. And of course, there is the additional point that some of the largest companies in the world also have some of the largest cash piles. So when we think about what is it that companies can do? Well, they have the potential to both protect themselves, but also to, I think, enhance the ability of the government to provide stimulus. The SBA loan program, Small Business Administration loan program, for example, in the USA, has now run out of money. They have lent out the entire $350 billion that had been allocated to them, and I think it's likely that the federal government is going to make more money available. What we have seen over the course of the last few years has been that companies like Facebook and Amazon in particular have been anxious to engage in some form of quasi-banking activity. Whether that is Amazon extending credit and loan facilities to its suppliers, third party and otherwise, whether it is Facebook attempting to create a cryptocurrency or also to mirror the kind of financial services that companies that it competes against, like Alibaba and WeChat, have integrated over the course of the last decade. Apple has also been thinking about the Apple Card, Apple Pay. So these are all companies that are already beginning to engage in quasi-financial services activities. There is the clear potential that they're going to try and use their very significant cash as a basis upon which to build a loan empire. And that, I think, is also something that the banking sector should be paying attention to. Banks remain under pressure. They have had one of the most modest of bounces, but they are still bouncing. And this is now another higher reaction low. So while the rebound has been modest, at least it is not breaking downwards. But that's very much in the USA. When we look at the European banking sector, then it is right on the region of the lows. Yes, it was in positive territory in here today, but was not able to hold the move, and it remains under acute distress. There is obviously the clear potential that some of the technology companies are in a better position to extend credit than most of the banking sector, and they just don't come with the legacy of large retail branch networks, large pension liabilities for their employees, and also they don't have a book of loans that are quickly going sour. So there are clear winners and losers to the broad macro environment that we have right now. On the one hand, we have the technology sector, which continues to advance in a really quite impressive fashion. I think people have been starting to look at its performance relative to the Russell 2000. So the NASDAQ 100 has been trending higher against the Russell 2000 for all of this bull market. And it is now rapidly approaching the peak that was put in during the tech bubble in 1999. I think it is worth considering that the technology sector today is substantially better capitalized than it was back in 1999. The bigger picture is, if you look at all the available history, it's that the much more concentrated mega cap index represented by the NASDAQ 100 has outperformed over a very long period of time, even if you were to excise the bubble in the 1990s from the data. The Russell 2000 is hampered by the fact that a large number of small companies do eventually fail. So that is obviously going to particularly act against it during a recession. And that's one of the reasons why the Russell has been pulling back so aggressively. There is the additional point that a number of the smaller companies are much more oriented to the legacy part of the domestic economy, whereas technology is much more oriented towards the newer part of the global economy. So that's an additional divergence. But I thought it was particularly relevant to point out that the momentum factor for the Russell 1000 has bounced pretty impressively. In fact, it is almost identical to the S&P 500. So we can definitely see that if one were to take the losers, and there are a lot of losers in the Russell, out, then the remainder of those companies do tend to do better. Now, when we think about what can we expect from the stock market over the next while, one, I think, important point is that over the course of secular bull markets, it's extraordinarily rare to see the index trade below the 1,000-day moving average. This is certainly the first time since 2011, and arguably the bull market started, conclusively started, around 2012 or 2013, when it broke out to new all-time highs. Now, those kind of long-term moving averages are not useful in a secular bear market. But we can also go back and look at the bull market in the 1990s and in the 1980s, and we can see that even in 1987, the stock market did not pull back below the 1,000-day moving average. We can go back to, that's the 1987 crash there. We have to go all the way back to 1982 to see a time when the 1,000-day moving average was below, or the price was below the 1,000-day moving average. Now, if we go back and think then about the big bull market that peaked in 1965 on a secular basis, well, then we do have a more spotty environment overall. There were times in the 1960s when the index did pull back below the 1,000-day moving average, and those were repeated reasonably often. So it was more of a hallmark during the major bull market of the 1980s and 1990s that saw the 1,000-day moving average being having its most efficacious period. It is also worth highlighting that it was really quite an impressive trend mean all the way from the late 1940s until the 1960s. So when we just simply look at that history, there have been occasions when the 1,000-day moving average has not offered support in secular bull markets. Now the big question is this one of those occasions when we spend a brief amount of time below it, or are we at a point where there's a secular change in trend? The clearest evidence that there is a secular change in trend is if the 200-day moving average crosses below the 1,000-day moving average. That's something that we haven't seen in the market since at least the period in 2007. We saw it again in 2001. That was a major turning point. We have to go all the way back to the 1970s until we saw it again. and that was the first really big one was in 1970. So then we had a much more volatile trading phase all the way through this entire period from 1965 through to the early 1980s. So now the big question is, what happens in the intermediate phase? Are we going to have an environment where we see the market go straight back up and above the 200-day moving average? Or are we going to see it encounter resistance around the 3,000 level? So far, we've had an incredibly impressive rebound. And when we think about, well, there's been a lot of discussion about whether the economy is going to have a V-shape, a U-shape, an I-shaped, a W-shaped, an L-shaped recovery. It seems like every week they add an extra letter to it. But that's not quite the same as thinking about, well, what's it like? What are we likely to see from the stock market? Because so far it's looking like a V-shaped recovery. We've seen an incredible pullback. We've seen an equally impressive rebound. Now, I think it is important to highlight that this massive reaction against the prevailing trend is a type 2 top formation. It then accelerated lower, and now we've had a very impressive rebound, and it is being fueled by massive liquidity provision. The size of assistance that is being provided by central banks the world over is completely without comparison. So that is a bullish force that is supporting the market. And we can see that there have been approximately $3 trillion added to the size of central bank balance sheets over the course of the last 6 weeks. So $500 billion a week is a really quite significant stimulus. And this trend continues higher. It has been rising for in a much more aggressive fashion since 2008. And it is likely to continue to accelerate higher overall. And that does suggest that we're going to see higher asset prices. The lockstep between the size of the Fed's balance sheet, the size of global balance sheets, and the performance of stock markets has been well remarked upon over the course of the last decade. So that is a bullish phenomenon. One of the factors that might argue against it is that buybacks have been approximately $4.2 trillion over the course of the last 12 years and hit another new all-time high last year. And 2018 and 19 were the only 2 years since 2007 where buybacks exceeded capex. And that's a really quite significant development. So the capital expenditure actually fell in 2019 and buybacks increased. Well, that does speak to higher leverage in the corporate sector. And especially when a number of companies have been using increasing debt to buy back their own shares. If they are in more difficult financial conditions right now, and most particularly if they've had to go to the market to take stimulus funds, then they are not going to be able to buy back their own shares with the same aggressive policy over the next couple of years at least. And that robs the market of a significant proportion of its potential source of demand. And that fits really very squarely into the type 2 top formation psychology, because markets will rally all day, all week, all month, provided they have liquidity and the bulls are continuing to allocate additional funds. Companies have been the biggest buyers of shares over the course of the last decade. And they are now constrained in their ability to continue to increase those positions. So in order for the market to persist higher, And to push on to new high ground, well, we are either going to have to see very significant margin expansion, we are going to have to see significantly more other investors come in to support this market, whether that is institutional investors or retail investors, to replace the demand from the corporate sector. But of course, we have to also pay attention to the fact that in order to sustain progressively higher prices, we need progressively more demand to continue to come into the market. Now, there is the potential that the Federal Reserve is going to be that source of demand. That is, I think, the biggest wild card that is helping to support markets. And it's backstopping the market. So I think it is likely that we have seen the low, that the lows are in fact in, and that when we think about what are the sectors that are doing best, well, the Dividend Aristocrats pulled back in an extraordinarily dramatic fashion. We saw yields on a significant number of these companies get up and above the something that I've often referred to as the magic number in terms of yields, which is 3.5%. And McDonald's, for example, got up to about 3.3% and has come straight back down. When we think about Johnson & Johnson, it's a very similar condition. It got up to about 3.2% and has, and the yield has started to come back down. When we think about Cisco, which is a company that has been heavily influenced by the closing down of restaurants and hotels, their yield got up to 4.5%, but it's now down to about 3.3%, and it's worth highlighting that the 4% level has never really been exceeded in the course of most of the last decade. So these are, I think, important points that we've never really seen 4% taken out. I think the, one of the limitations of these kinds of charts I'm using is that they don't update dynamically. So we just don't see the move higher on the intraday basis, which is why I am focusing more on the weeklies. Now, when we think about the Dividend Aristocrats sector, then there is also the additional point that a number of companies within it tend to grow their dividends at an aggressive pace. Roper Technologies is one of those, and the share is also rallying well off its lows. I think it is reasonable to anticipate that Dividend Aristocrats, particularly those that are on the S&P 500 and have never cut their dividend in at least 25 years, are going to do anything to ensure that they can sustain those dividend increases, even if they have to reduce their dividend growth rate. But then it comes down also to their dividend payout ratios. And some of these companies have got comparatively low dividend payout ratios, some only 11%. And obviously that is not universal right across the board. But these types of companies that have got solid businesses, that have got strong cash flows, strong balance sheets, long records of paying dividends, and are leveraged to renewal in the economy are likely to continue to benefit. And in an environment where we have got the widest differential between the yield on treasuries and that on the S&P 500 ever, then the argument for owning equities over bonds, but most particularly those types of companies that either can grow their dividend well beyond any expectation of what inflation is likely to be, or those that can grow faster than the rate of inflation or significantly faster than the rate of inflation, are obviously the ones that are most likely to attract interest from investors. Because while politicians the world over have been saying that this is not the time to worry about deficits. I think investors are of the opposite opinion. This is exactly the time to worry about deficits, because eventually they're going to have to get paid. And the reality is that when we think about what is going on in terms of the government finances, that governments are increasingly willing to massively increase their deficits. And we have been through a decade of fiscal austerity, and that's particularly true in Europe. And people are sick of it. The fact that that President Trump won the election in 2016 was a visceral response to the fact that living standards had not been rising, despite the fact the government had rescued large parts of the economy. Living standards did not rise. The benefits of globalization flowed to corporations and flowed to consumers in emerging markets, but not to consumers who lost their jobs. And there has been a clear lack of new jobs, particularly for people that had been reasonably well compensated in previous parts of the economy. One of the reasons why manufacturing tends to be where the sector that gets outsourced most quickly is because manufacturing jobs generally pay more. Those workers tend to get better wages because of the volatility in their the structure of their sector. Historically, manufacturing takes the biggest hit during a recession, but then it bounces back stronger. And historically, our workers have been compensated for that risk. The sectors that you can't offshore have always been heavily remunerated as well, such as coal mining or lumberjacking or mining, and those generally tend to be highly compensated because of the danger element. Of course, the other point is that you can't offshore those types of enterprises. But what you can do is you can optimize so that you use less of them. And that has been one of the factors that has affected coal mining everywhere. And it is also why coal miners tend to be most militant. We don't get the same kind of militancy in manufacturing jobs, but we definitely see it militancy rising in just about all coal mining communities, because they were highly remunerated. They had the funds and the will to try and ensure that the survival of their industry. So we've certainly seen disaffection. We've seen people being disenfranchised, and enough of them have contributed to the populist wave. And when we see governments that are printing money like it's literally going out of fashion, well, they can get away with that because the velocity of money has been trending downwards for decades. It started to trend downwards right around the same time as the e-commerce sector started up, which was right around 1997. And this is reported with a lag. It's reported quarterly with a quarter lag. So it's 6 months out of date. And we're not going to get the next update until the end of April. And even then, that is only going to give us the data for the last quarter of the end of the third quarter in 2019. You don't need a crystal ball to think that velocity of money has been contracting when most of the global economy has been mothballed. So you can increase the size of the monetary supply almost indefinitely when velocity of money is zero. Where you start to get inflationary pressures is when wage demand growth starts to pick up, when you get referred to as monetary financing in the 1970s, where central banks, which were not generally independent, had a clear hand-in-hand approach with governments, and they simply printed the currency that the government required for infrastructure development, for housing development, and that sowed the seeds for inflation. Now, when we think about what is likely to come out of the coronavirus, well, we've already seen that so-called essential workers are being offered danger pay of anything up to about $2 an hour on top of what they're making. It's going to be very illustrative of whether we do get inflationary pressures if companies can in fact remove that $2 increment when people go back to work. We're also going to see in the restaurant sector that wages have been rising really at an accelerating rate heading into this crisis. That is either going to turn out that the restaurant sector is going to have to shed workers. We're already seeing that automation is creeping in the for example, in McDonald's, where there are touchscreen ordering forms rather than queuing up at the counter. And I think that that is that kind of automation technology is going to find its way into an increasingly large proportion of all service sectors as wages rise. Obviously, when we think about the manufacturing sector, it's something that is also going to inhibit the ability of manufacturing jobs to migrate back to higher cost economies. But it is almost certainly going to ensure that we get increasing automation. But eventually, if economic growth starts to pick up, and I think it is reasonable to anticipate that economic growth is going to pick up from where it is right now, it might take a couple of quarters, it might take 3 or 4 quarters to get back to the kind of growth rates that we had before the crisis. And the IMF is anticipating that growth rates in 2021 will be in the order of 6% on a global basis. So they're anticipating a very strong recovery. But one thing that I think is going to be a lasting effect of the coronavirus is suspicion of China's motives. And when we think about the potential for economic growth, the potential for people to get back to normal life, I think that it's a given. When I remember being in Bangkok during the SARS epidemic, and the domestic population, they were completely nonplussed by the risk. But when I looked around at the people I was traveling with, who were an international group of divers, then people were very nervous about touching anything in the city. But that scare, and it was obviously a smaller scare than the one we've just had, that really did disappear over the course of the next year or two. Most people were terrified of flying in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, and yet passenger numbers just continued to climb in the decade afterwards. Everyone is worried about flying and eating out and socializing right now, but once we have an effective treatment, once we have vaccines, and that's probably going to be within the next couple of quarters, once we have effective testing regimes and the potential that, it was announced in here this week that Apple and Google are coordinating so that they're going to create an app that people can opt into, so that in the event that people are diagnosed, that trace trace sourcing is going to be a lot easier for those people or anyone that came into contact with someone who's infected. These kinds of measures are all going to ensure that we have the security to get back into normal life within the next 6 months. And it's at that point then we're going to have to start thinking about, what is the the challenge that is emerging from inflation. Now, in the short term, it's likely that what we're going to have is deflation. And gold prices were in negative territory today, and they are overbought in the short term. And we could easily have some consolidation. Silver prices, having rallied impressively over the course of the last few days, were also a little softer in here. And platinum prices have been steadying around the $800 area. We definitely have negative real interest rates. And I think this is something that is going to remain a significant bullish factor for the precious metals sector over the course of the next few years. There is the clear potential that because gold is appreciating in every currency, that highlights a number of factors. On the one hand, it tells us that there is no country wants to have a strong currency, that some currencies are certainly weaker than others, particularly the commodity producers. And the commodity producers are also quite often some of the biggest producers of gold. We're seeing, for example, the Swiss franc pushed on to new highs against gold in here this week, that China briefly hit a new all-time high in the price of gold. I think all of these are significant landmark events, but it's not so much that gold is overbought in the short term or that it is susceptible to some pause of consolidation. But the much more important point is that when we look at the price of gold against any one of the major currencies, it is only the US dollar is the currency that it hasn't been able to break out to new all-time highs against. And that is not especially any particular reason why one has to be bullish of the dollar, but it would appear to be only a matter of time before gold finally also moves on to a new high against the US dollar. Now, when we look at the dollar index, there are these competing factors that are being considered by investors. We've had some extraordinary volatility, but the net event is that over the course of the last 2 months, we've had a triangular pattern forming where we have lower highs and higher lows. And that kind of triangular pattern generally will contribute to a breakout that will be sustained. The USA is printing more money than anyone. So it is logical to think that the dollar should go down. One of the reasons it has not yet gone down is because the economic impact from the coronavirus and the response to it is worse elsewhere than it is in the USA. So that's supporting the dollar on a relative basis. But one thing that is, I think, noteworthy is that a number of markets of currencies have steadied against the dollar. The Mexican peso is benefiting from Mexico's hedge against oil. So the peso has steadied. The Philippine peso has been almost inert over the course of the last 4 months. And that is, I think, really quite a trend that is quite remarkable, that it has in fact been going up against the dollar for most of the last couple of years. Now, whether that is sustainable or not is open to debate, but it is certainly helping to support the market on a medium-term basis. The South Korean won has also steadied, having briefly pushed on to a new low around the 1250 area. Then the won has steadied again. There is the potential, at least, that some currencies are going to start to appreciate against the US dollar. It might be a while before other emerging market currencies can rally in a very meaningful way, but we are starting to see at least some evidence, not so much in the commodity producers, where The Brazilian real has been under pressure, but in some of the higher growth, bigger population markets, for example, the Indonesian rupiah has been steadying over the course of the last week. The Vietnamese dong is another currency which has been comparatively steady. So we can clearly see that there are going to be winners and losers in the emerging markets sector, in just the same way that some countries in Europe, like Greece and Germany, have been able to sidestep the worst of the coronavirus deaths, while Spain and Italy have fallen victim to just been completely caught flat-footed and unprepared by the spread of the virus. That's, I think, something that we're going to see more of, that there will certainly be clear winners and losers. And we are likely to continue to see a significant divergence between the winners and losers in the on Wall Street in particular. We're also likely to see that unemployment is going to be somewhat slower to come back because of the difficulties that businesses already have, whether that is higher wages or higher regulatory costs or the impact of the coronavirus on consumer behavior. That's going to weigh on the restaurant sector, weigh on the hotel sector. And there are a number of seasonal businesses that are probably going to have to write this season off because of the fall off in demand for hotel spaces. So I think that's certainly something that is going to impact demand in the short term. Obviously, it's a bigger challenge for companies that have taken on a lot of debt. So Marriott, for example, has pulled back in an incredibly aggressive manner. They've gone to the debt markets and they've been borrowing more money. They've been also helped by the fact that the Federal Reserve is buying the investment grade and high yield bonds. So despite the fact that we're likely to have a varied response in terms of the winners and losers, the fact that the Federal Reserve is buying high yield bonds and is likely to also buy equities is something that is likely to contribute to the lows holding. Even when we don't have the buybacks, the fact that money is being made available, that the Federal Reserve is expanding its balance sheet in an aggressive manner, the likelihood is that we have seen the lows. So if that's the case, then what we should anticipate is that we're going to get at least some consolidation. Just because a low has been found does not mean that the market has to go straight back up and exceed the high. There is going to be an economic slowdown, and we are already in a recession. Coming out of the recession is going to take time, and consumers are going to take time to get their confidence back. There is going to be a wave of defaults. That is going to be particularly true of the commercial real estate sector. We've already seen that big companies like Primark and H&M and a number of others have stopped paying rents. The restaurant sector is going to have to space out its tables, so that means fewer patrons, but they still have high rents, so a significant number of those smaller businesses are going to go to the wall. There is going to have to be additional funds made available to the corporate sector, particularly small businesses, to keep them afloat, and some are just not going to survive. So those are certainly going to be transition events that happen in the market. That suggests that deflation is what we're going to have in the near term, and inflation is quite likely in the long term. And when we then think about what we can anticipate from the government bond markets, well, the 10-year yield is still hovering around the 50 basis point level. When we look at the yield curve spread, it's right now around 44 basis points, but it's not rallying higher. It's still contained. I think this is exactly what we can anticipate, that what we now have with the Federal Reserve buying long and short and being actively engaged in the repo market, the commercial paper market, high yield bonds, investment grade bonds, that what it is effectively doing is managing the yield curve in a manner very similar to what they did in Japan. There is, however, a tendency to, among investors to think that because the USA is doing that, that they're likely to have a Japanese-style event. But there is the alternative example that of Switzerland. Switzerland has been buying, in fact, U.S. equities now for most of the last 5 or 6 years, and that hasn't had a deleterious effect on their growth rates. If we simply think about where value is represented, the fact that equities have got such wide yield advantages over treasuries, and that the largest companies have got some of the highest cash piles, and that they have got, and the companies that have got the long histories of paying dividends, they have got the cash to do so, and their dividend payout ratios are not demanding. These are the kinds of instruments that offer bond-like characteristics, and they represent less risky investments than government bonds and have got considerable potential for capital appreciation on top of that. Eventually, we are going to get an inflationary outcome. Monetary financing on the scale that is being adopted right now is inevitably going to result in inflation. And in that event, gold and income-producing assets of real businesses are going to have a clear value. And bonds are something that have already priced in most of the good news that applies to them. So I think this is the time to be thinking about locking down income, because it's going to become an increasingly valuable asset. That, I think, is why we're seeing the companies that pay strong dividends and grow their dividends doing so much better. And if that is true of of Wall Street, it is equally true of the UK in particular, where the FTSE 100 yields 5.3% and the 10-year gilt yields less than 50 basis points. In fact, it's 30 basis points. Well, then the logical argument for allocating to the equity market is very clear. When we look at, for example, the FTSE 250, it pulled back in an incredibly dynamic manner, but it still yields 4.45%. When we think about Australia, where they've just engaged in quantitative easing, and have now, and that is really flogging the currency. The dividend yield on the ASX 200 is 5%. When we think about the fact that the 10-year government bond yield has contracted meaningfully over the last decade and is now around 85 basis points, well, then we're getting a substantial pickup in yield just simply by buying equities. But the additional point is that dividend growth improves the yield of equities the longer they're held. That is not the case with bonds. The fact that we have extraordinarily low interest rates means that the responsibility for generating total return in the bond market falls squarely on capital appreciation, because you're getting nothing on the yield. And that reliance on capital appreciation is extraordinarily sensitive to inflationary pressures. So yes, we do have deflation as an animating factor in the markets now, but that is unlikely to remain the case. We can think about it in a number of different ways, obviously with wage growth and populism being one. Then we have the fact that monetary financing and the unwillingness of governments to even begin to talk about how deficits are going to be repaid, that's two. But then we have China. And this is, I think, one of the factors that is less appreciated. China lies about everything. So it really brings to life the liar's paradox, which is, I'm a liar, said the liar. Do you believe them or not? And you can only measure a liar by their actions rather than what they say. And their actions are that they're preparing for war. There is clear intelligence that they are experimenting with small nuclear devices. They're sinking fishing vessels. They're very actively trying to enforce a cordon in the South China Sea. They're building islands. They're building a blue water navy. And they are investing heavily in next generation technology. And they are engaging in a globally active propaganda war. They are engaging in diplomatic efforts the world over to try and sway governments to their will. And that is all, those are all substantive, clear actions. Regardless of statements to the contrary, we have evidence in the affirmative. And that is the clear conclusion, that China is preparing for war. They may not be ready yet, but they're certainly preparing. Now, back in 2000, the global corporate sector, in conjunction with their governments, made the determination that there was massive margin expansion to be had by outsourcing manufacturing, and that by doing so, that China could be civilized, and that they would become a willing partner with the flowering of democracy with the G7. Well, they were certainly right by outsourcing manufacturing. It certainly raised living standards. It certainly helped to boost margins for the corporate sector internationally. It created a global supply chain, just-in-time manufacturing, just-in-time inventory management. All contributed to wider margins in the corporate sector. And it is quite likely that that is now over. The bet that all of that would contribute to improving the willingness of China to become a global partner has proved futile. Certainly when we think about the fact that Chinese administrators were studying with Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore. And the problem always between a teacher and a student is that the teacher thinks that they're teaching one thing, and the student is liable to pick up a very different lesson. So Singapore thought that they were teaching China about the merits of good governance, and that with good governance, that massive economic growth and improving standards of living can be attained for all. What China instead learned was that by adopting economic growth, you can sustain a single-party government and make a lot of money in the process. They just forgot about learning about good governance and freedom of expression and ingenuity and the rule of law. So that is the condition that we have today. They have adopted an economic model and international competition without the rule of law, without freedom, and with a heavy-handed approach to governance that is being exported internationally. And that is something that the rest of the world is now waking up to. But if we are going to decouple from China, it is going to have an inflationary effect. So it is obviously we're in an environment where there are going to be clear winners and losers. There are going to be sections of the emerging markets that benefit enormously from decoupling from China. India is certainly one of the leading candidates in that regard. And the Nifty continues to rally, but the Indian rupee remains under pressure. And the rupee has been devaluing for an awfully long time. The one thing India needs more than anything is manufacturing. And if they can get manufacturing off the ground and the infrastructure and port facilities that requires, then India represents a key potential ally for the West in combating China. And I think that has to be the base case, and not least because India does have the rule of law. They also have a respect for attempting to improve governance. Now, that governance might be coming off a very low base, but governance has been improving, and the trend of governance improving has certainly been better than the trend of governance in China. If we are indeed moving to a decoupling, then India should do better. It's been a much better investment destination than China from the perspective of a stock market investor for decades already. And I suspect that is likely to remain the case. Therefore, inflation would appear to be the logical conclusion, despite the fact that we have got issues in the short term. What that suggests is that income-producing assets and gold are going to be among the most prized, and technology is going to remain a competitive sector generating value on a secular basis. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.